Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Greenwashed. You're with Don Nicholson. I'm Jaspreet, and we are back again today with one of our former guests. In fact, nearly a year ago, we had Larry Blair on Greenwashed, and we spoke about how the current state of our energy sector at that point, July 2023, how vulnerable was it, and what Larry's thoughts were on this particular issue of energy security. And we covered quite a bit there. Now, Larry has been in the energy sector for a while. You have worked offshore, Larry, and currently you're on the production side of things in Taranaki. So welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, Jaspreet.
Yeah, so a year from then.
Yep.
Yeah, so what's changed?
Well, obviously, we've had the new government come in, and they're very pro-extractive industries, as far as we can tell so far, making lots of noises about overturning some of the legislation and things that were put in place by the previous government, with a view to hopefully shoring up New Zealand's energy security. So it was actually interesting. I think it was probably about a month back. There was a bit of a dust up in Parliament, actually, and Simeon Brown issued a communication basically to spell out the dire gas situation that we've got. And that was after the GIC, which is a gas industry company, had I think they must have reported on the 2024 reserve profiles that all the operators would have put through early this year. So and obviously that's not looking good. So
so when you came,
our problem. Yep.
When we spoke last year, Larry, you spoke, I think you mentioned the fact that we have 7 years worth of gas reserves left. So, you know, we should have 6 years worth of gas reserves left now. You also mentioned the fact that we are a small island, so far off from the rest of the world. Oil exploration is expensive, but we have spooked people, spooked the industry, because regardless of who comes into government, we were speaking that time with the Ardern government or the Labour government in power. And you mentioned the fact that people used to look at New Zealand and say, all right, it's expensive, it's far off, but politically there is no threat. And you mentioned then that even if the new government comes and overturns all of this, you have spooked a sector. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's still the situation. It's going to be very, very, very difficult for this government to reinstate any confidence for investment. I think you can probably create some confidence amongst the operators that are already here, potentially. But to get any sort of large-scale investment, it's going to be really, really difficult. I don't even know what the legislative mechanism would look like to do that. You would have to potentially introduce some sort of compensation mechanism so that if you change the Crown Minerals Act, say, for example, a future government, that they would need to compensate anyone that suffers losses as a result of that change, or something like that. That's the only way I could see that you can do it. Otherwise, you're in this constant yo-yo between
one government and the next.
Exactly. And it's that same, the center ground's been lost, and we've got this the same sort of political phenomenon that you're seeing all around the world now, where the left has sort of gone really, really left, and there's no middle ground anymore. It's either one extreme or the other, which makes it very, very difficult for people to make investment decisions. And as you said, like, New Zealand's a long way away from all of the key infrastructure that it takes to develop these sorts of things. So, and then the other problem is just the lead time here is, even just to get a permit to drill offshore, it's sort of like an 18-month process just to get the consents in place before you even...
How does that compare with, say, a country in Europe or somewhere else? Is that really bad?
I don't know about Europe, but, like Asia and stuff, you wouldn't have those hurdles. The consenting process would be a lot more rapid. It might be not quite as
rigorous.
Yeah, or it's might be a bit more of who you know than what you know, but it is possible to do things
Faster.
quickly.
Isn't it interesting how it's well known that confidence to and have investment is, well, to invest is vital in any Western democracy anyway. And yet we have government meddling in what could be called that confidence area. And they know they've done it. They know they've done it. They know they've destabilized the confidence, but they don't appear to have any sort of feeling for the repercussion. So my concern is, as Jaspreet and you have just talked about, though, is how do you turn that tap back on with enough
Well,
confidence? I know you've talked.
it's a really complicated picture, Don. And I mean, we could have a discussion on history here and the virtues of Western legal systems and that sort of thing, and separation of state and powers, which is why the investments occurred in a lot of cases. But the oil and gas situation's a lot more complicated in that not only do you need investor confidence, you also need a market. And that's where New Zealand's a little bit stuck at the moment. And going back to your earlier comment, Jasper, you said, when we last spoke, we had 7 years of gas left, and so we should have now have six. That's not the case either. It's much more dire than that. So, as of December last year, we got a forecast from the GIC again, which caused a bit of stir. But basically, what they were saying is that supply can't meet demand by 2025. So, as early as next year, we're going to see a situation where we can't actually supply enough gas to meet the current market demand. Now, the domestic market in New Zealand for consumer gas is quite small. So, it's not particularly supportive of large infrastructure investments and exploration costs. So you need some big consumers, right? So you need the Balance agri nutrients and you need the Methanex, right? So the petrochemical sector is where the majority of the gas has always gone, and they have largely bankrolled a lot of the future development that's occurred in the history of Taranaki's oil and gas sector, right? So now you've got this situation where we potentially can't supply Methanex enough gas for production. But then if they exit the market, then we've got an oversupply in terms of the remaining market, which would then mean that some of the high-cost operators would find it really difficult to continue, right? And high-cost operators are the ones that are offshore, so that they've got the biggest OPEX that they need to recover through their sales. So
Who's going to be paying that cost?
it's really fragile. So and so the government started this, I forget the name of it now, but it's a they've got together with the industry sector and they're trying to have a emergency forum
Emergency.
meeting,
Okay, yep.
to try and figure out how to respond to this and what they can do to incentivize and get things going again. But it's a little bit of a slow moving train crash, right? So I mean this has started 20 years ago essentially, and successive governments have all
Just
failed
carried on.
to consider energy security, I think. Well, that's my opinion anyway. And
And
now we're in the situation where we've got a very, very short time frame to respond, and the lead time for any of the options that you would respond with is far greater than the time available.
now, and New Zealanders are not used to load shedding, like, say, someone like I am. I've grown up in places where dad was posted where every day on peak months, there'd be a 4 hours of power shedding. You knew load shedding. And the being in a military cantonment, the generators would fire up. But you were used to it. You knew not to get a block of ice cream in those months or just get one right when you're ready to eat. And all of that. I mean, that's how we were used to life in certain, remote places. Kiwis are not used to that. And you only have to
No.
look back at the headlines over the last few days where it has been the far north, Papillon down, 100,000 houses out of power. Or more recently, over the weekend, the Chathams have run out of fuel. So there's no fuel in the Chathams at all. Net zero nirvana isn't quite what they make it out to be, is it?
Well, this is one of the byproducts of going to intermittent, power supplies. So, the wind and the solar are highly dependent on currently in New Zealand gas and coal for firming capacity. So, obviously the hydro runs as a base load, and then you've got these intermittent supplies that are jumping in and out, and then you've got coal and gas, which are acting essentially as peakers, but the reality is that they are operating pretty much all the time now, so to meet the market. So as we tail out of gas, then it is like you say, it's going to get really, really difficult to balance and control the grid, and particularly in that dry winter scenario, it's very, very difficult at that point.
And we've already had indications of potential for blackouts in the last month. There has been some, some tension around: have we got enough juice to supply the country at certain points? And so the warnings are there. And listening to recent discussion with Brian Leyland, it clearly is a bother that New Zealanders haven't realised that intermittent power through wind and solar, if you can't store it, it's sort of awkward to manage. Sure, if the lakes are low, you're going to use most of it. But the other side of it is the safety and security of adding it to the grid is a problem. There's a myriad of problems. And of course, the nameplate capacity of wind and solar is never what comes out of it. It's because sometimes the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine every day. So, or at night. So, very common to know those things, but we're still being told these things are really, really handy and we should have them, and worse. And I've read your Substacks about the cost of offshore wind, and that is unbelievably mind-boggling to see the size of that cost per kilowatt hour or megawatt compared to onshore, yet we still want to persevere with that sort of stuff. Why? Where's the logic and reason here? I mean, what is the perfect energy mix in this country? We just don't seem to have it. We used to have it,
Well,
perhaps.
the logic and reason is that it's this whole net zero, carbon neutral, renewable energies, the go-to thing, right? So this is the political zeitgeist that you see across the world at the moment. Now, that creates a lot of issues, and in the fact of the intermittency, and with the intermittency, as you've mentioned, the capacity factor. So when you're talking about solar in this latitude, you're talking as low as 15%. So if you have a megawatt of solar, you might get 150 watts, 1500 watts, 15% of that capacity. And then with the wind, even offshore, you're probably talking high 30%, maybe touching on 40, but there's a lot of issues there as well. So, low energy density equals high resource intensity, and that's why things cost so much, right? So, if you're trying to harvest a really low energy density source, which is solar or wind, then you need a lot of resources to do that, and that's where the cost comes in, and then the recovery of the capital becomes really problematic if you've only going to generate, say, 30% of the nameplate value. So then you start talking about things like strike rates, and which is paying for capacity essentially that you're not getting in terms of generation. So it's becomes a very, very complicated project. Now, you asked me what the perfect solution would be, and it was interesting. I was actually looking for something the other day, and I came across an article from the New Zealand Geographic about nuclear in New Zealand and all the plans right through to 1977, I think, was when they actually dropped the whole thing. But at that point, the government was very, very much looking at it, and to the extent that they were actually training people, and they had plans to build a 1 gigawatt plant north of Auckland, somewhere I think it was, Kaitaia Harbour or somewhere I think it might have been, and that's where you start to, that would pair beautifully with hydro, And then you have actually got that panacea of this zero emission grid, but it's all baseload generated with high capacity factor. And you're seeing the debate in Australia at the moment about the nuclear. You know, you've got one political faction's talking about building seven new nuclear stations, and then the others very much in the renewable space. And there's a lot of scientific commentary, which is political science, but it's interesting the numbers they're coming up with, because as you mentioned, some of these things are horrendously expensive.
Well, and that's a question I'd like, if you can answer this, is what is the cost per megawatt hour for current nuclear energy versus hydro versus intermittent wind or solar? The way I
So
read it, nuclear
it
is
was
by
interesting.
far the cheapest.
I wouldn't say it's by far the cheapest. It is expensive, but it's about the approach. So if you were to take the American or Canadian approach to it, and it's a very much a bespoke approach, it has been very, very, very expensive for them. Nuclear, that is. If you were to take more of a South Korean approach, which is a modular approach, they choose one type of reactor. They build that. When they do the civil work. Civil work's probably the main major cost involved with nuclear. Then they did do a big pad, and they set it up so that they can keep adding reactors to the same pad. You know, so they've got a cost that's down to about $2,300 per kilowatt as a CapEx number. And for comparison, I was looking at a court case about the Revolution 2 wind project, which is an offshore wind project in Massachusetts. And they were talking about numbers for their CapEx of $6,000 a kilowatt hour, so three times that, which is interesting as well, right? So and then when you compare, installed capacity versus capacity factor, then it gets really difficult to justify those sorts of expenditures.
Well, and I, logic in my brain said to me that what Peter Dutton, the opposition leader in Australia, was saying made perfect sense. I mean, they've got coal pad units at certain places where they've got the grid emanating from. Why wouldn't you reuse those? If you're going to be closing down your coal power stations, why wouldn't you just put your nuclear stations sort of there, and already you've got the grid ready to transport the electricity?
Attach.
And you wouldn't have all this tension that's going on at the moment in Australia with, what is it, 10,000 miles of or kilometers of new transmission lines through supposedly protected areas. So it would sort of take the tension and the heat out of that, I would have thought, but that's just me.
Yeah, so that's one approach that's been talked about. I think Ontario is actually like a good example of this. They have done quite a lot of that of repurposing previous sites and reinvigorating nucleus and that sort of thing, which is a lower cost approach, and it's easier, as you say, the infrastructure is already there. And this is one of the big challenges that the renewable sector is facing at the moment, is that quite often they're far away from where the populations are, and they're trying to this feast or famine type approach to the transmission is also difficult. So you've got to develop a grid base, your land-based grid that can support the full generation capacity or very little, and that's quite an engineering challenge. Whereas if you go to the more baseload type things where nuclear comes in using existing sites, then the existing transmission networks work as well.
Yeah, and you talked about perhaps some privilege for this intermittent electricity to get into the market. So basically, they get, it sounds like, is that what the revenue stabilization mechanism is? I think, and it's also called curtailment
So it
in
was
Australia.
interesting. I was reading the offshore wind people were talking about the fast track consenting process, and obviously the government's pulled wind out of the fast track consenting process. They're trying to develop a mechanism for that. I suspect it's probably going to be quite similar to the oil and gas mechanism, with a marine consent type approach through the EPA. Anyway, the crux of it was that the wind people were basically saying that even with that mechanism in place, there's still not going to be the market conditions supportive to developing wind, and they were talking about revenue stabilization, but that's just another term for a strike rate, as far as I can determine. Not having a seat at the table or understanding fully what they're pushing for, but I believe they'd be looking for something like a strike rate, which is what you see in other jurisdictions around the world. And what a strike rate is they guarantee a price for per megawatt, right? So, yeah. I think in the UK now they're looking at something like £170 per megawatt is the strike rate, and basically what that means is that you're guaranteed to receive that value for the power you generate, even if the market's saturated at that time. And the trade-off for that is that if the market's below that value, you're supposed to pass on the difference back to the government or the consumer, essentially, right? So so it sounds good on paper, but when you start looking at those capacity factors, you can see exactly. You only have to look at the energy markets in Europe to see most of them have increased, you know, multiples over the recent years. So, you know, we're talking 200-400, even 500-600% in some cases increases in energy prices.
Right. Now, since we last spoke, listeners, in case any one of you is on Substack, Larry, you have a Substack that you write regularly on. It's called New Zealand Energy. I do subscribe to that one. And I was listening, I was watching your output over the last few months. In May, you wrote this article on two headlines that should not come as a surprise. And there you mentioned that as you were writing that Substack article, the country was generating a total of something like 3% of the capacity. I mean, you said, as I write, with 1,259 megawatts of wind in the generation capacity in this country, we were generating a total of 35 megawatts. That is 3% of the installed capacity. This was May the 9th when the Substack article of yours came out. 3%. And we are now talking of revenue stabilization. I mean, I call it a subsidy again, a kickback, whichever way. We are rewarding the inefficient child, the inefficient worker, the slacker, the in any other way you'd be calling it in a workplace, you'd be calling it rewarding the non-performer, basically. But that's what they want us to do. So MB's paper that you're referring to, it's called Developing a Regulatory Framework for Offshore Renewable Energy. And they say offshore wind projects have high upfront capital costs, low operational costs, long operational lives. And revenue stabilization mechanisms are designed to provide prospective lenders with confidence that regular payments can be met. Yet they have taken the same confidence away from the oil and gas sector, which provided us power, energy that was stable, that could be counted upon. And they want to reward this petulant child of wind energy, which you can't count on. If this is not stupid, I don't know what is stupid. We are actually at a race to the bottom here. And no one seems to, I think, grasp this, that we are so far away from the rest of the world. It's not like turning a pipeline on or, hey, asking Qatar, can you, you know, push some supplies down to Germany or something? We have nothing. If we decimate our energy supply, we don't have that sort of a fallback on about it, just making a call to a neighbor and getting the power delivered.
Yeah, and this is why the energy security sort of strategy or awareness has been such a concern for me over recent years in New Zealand. It is that island situation. You know, we don't have the infrastructure to import natural gas. We don't have enough generation capacity without the natural gas.
We don't have a Nord Stream. Yeah.
What do we do, right? And I think, you know, everyone's grabbing at any sort of solution, and obviously we do have some wind. So wind has sort of come to the front as here's the solution. We need power. We can do it with this, right? But as you've alluded to, at what cost? And the, you know, coming back to those numbers I was talking about earlier for Don, that came out of a court case for the consenting of this Revolution 2 wind farm. So that $6,000 a kilowatt in CapEx was nearly six times what the combined cycle gas comparison was for the same region. And the OPEX was double for the wind farm versus the combined cycle gas. So,
the Patreon Ospor, super expensive, erratic power.
Yeah. But coming back to the market condition, I think Brian painted a really good picture the other week when he was talking about all of our generators are currently incentivized to create scarcity and then chase those higher bid values, which is another problem. So the whole market needs potentially needs a restructure to generate some sort of certainty for investment. I don't think that's contentious at all, and that the current market model is probably not fit for purpose. What that looks like and how that would work with coupling in these sort of intermittent power supplies is probably my biggest concern at this stage.
Brian was hot about that, as you rightly say, the market is broken, the market system we have in this country for our electricity supply. But there doesn't seem to be any willingness to change it after, what, almost 40 years, 35 years since the Bradford reforms. There doesn't appear to be any willingness that I'm reading of or about to change anything. As much as Brian or yourself may have a view, are you detecting there is now a willingness to say that it's broken and does need fixed?
Well, I think there needs, you know, the advocates of the renewable would definitely push for market reform. I think you'll see the solar, the industrial solar guys are already talking that they've sort of reached saturation. So at that midday on the sunny day, they're generating enough power now into a market they're starting to compete with the baseload hydro and that sort of thing. So, which is driving the price down. You actually see this quite a lot in Europe. You actually see negative power prices midday, which is difficult for them as well, right? So they're now trying to sell power. If they're selling it on the spot market, it's really difficult. So unless they've got sort of power purchase agreements in place that at an agreed rate for that power that they're generating, then they're a little bit stuck. So they're reaching a point where they need some sort of market intervention to keep them profitable. The wind people obviously are talking up publicly and openly about needing some market intervention to be able to invest at the rates of capex that they need to do that. And then obviously with gas becoming scarce and the price spiking on that, just the general rate for peaker plants, and you know we're quite often up over $350 a megawatt hour in New Zealand, which is very, very high. I mean, I can't remember the last time I looked at my power bill, but it was about 28 cents a kilowatt hour, I think. So I'm actually below the wholesale power rate without any of the distribution costs, so Transpower, my local power network, all that sort of thing. So that's not sustainable and can't carry on either. So what I'm expecting is that we're going to see big power price increases in the coming year, and that's going to create a lot of political pressure for market reform as well. But I can't see with intermittent supply generation and an absence of gas that we're going to get any relief there through any sort of market intervention. I think it's only going north, and it's going to go north significantly, which is not a good situation for anyone trying to do business in this country, particularly when we're a commodities market exporting into international markets and competing against others that have got billions of tons of coal.
But of course, this was the Build Back Better and the Just Transition. Larry, this is all smarter and better than ever before. You know, we wanted to electrify our boilers, we wanted to electrify our cars, we wanted to increase demand, but it was all sort of non-market based. Chickens are coming home to roost when you do that.
I mean, getting a little bit sort of philosophical here, but you know, biology first, right? Like it's biology, and we. the maximum power principle. You know, we'll try and optim. We're a species like any other species that will optimize an energy gradient. So, whatever energy we've got available, we'll try and optimize for it and use as much as possible. So, to try and deny yourself of various energies, it doesn't help, and it doesn't create any wins, because you know Jevons' paradox, which is the you know, no, there's no efficiency gains, just lead to more use of energy, right? So anything we don't use here, someone else will use somewhere else, and anything that we can do for less, we do more of. So well, abundance of energy is the only way forward as far as you know any sort of prosperity or wealth in this nation.
Yeah, I think abundant low-cost energy is the key. I mean, we can have abundant high-cost energy, and that's not going to help either, is it? We want abundant low-cost. Yeah, yeah.
Not given right. to these erratic so, jumps, yeah.
So going back to gas, sorry, I don't mean to put you off your train of thought there, but are we going to have to import gas? Is that what we've got to do to sort of fill the void very soon?
It could come to that, potentially. It's difficult to say. I looked at the reserve profiles a while back in one of my articles here, and no one's got a lot of gas. They've all got small pockets of gas. I see NZEC are actually developing a field at the moment, but they're still only talking, I think it was 13 PJs of gas, 1.3. So that's less than 10% of what we'd use on an annual basis. So although it sounds, you know, exciting and there's some gas and someone's drilling a hole, that's nice, but it's very, very small amounts. Some of the, I think the Mackay-Mangehewa fields looked okay, but again, we're not talking more than a couple hundred PJs of additional reserves that could be recovered there potentially. And these are all sort of very subjective things, you know, like you drill a hole and on paper it looks good, but the reality can be somewhat different. And there's a lot of challenges there, particularly with these late life fields. You know, where is the water interface? You know, are you actually going to get something, or are you just going to get more headaches for your process? So we could be in a situation where we do need to import gas. Yes, Don, that is a possibility. But again, we don't actually have any infrastructure for that at the moment. And what would the timeline look like for that? You know, would we need to look at some of these emergency FSRU type solutions that Germany had to deploy for on the back of the Nord Stream pipeline for LNG imports? And what's the cost? You know, spot market or LNG is pretty volatile, and it is quite expensive. You know, European winters and stuff, it can be very high compared to what our domestic gas rates are.
If we put ourselves in that sort of a position, beggars can't be choosers. We'll have to take whatever we can get. And talking of that, the fiscal state of the country is not that great to be able to afford that. When we spoke last time, Don mentioned the fact that the royalties, the lack of, you know, or the fall in the amount of royalties that come from these explorations, we would have foregone some of those. Don't know how many of those would come back now that we've spooked this industry. But other than that, we've gone from our net debt was about $5 billion in 2019. It has crossed $70 billion. That has to be repaid somehow. And without energy, how do we do that? How do we remain productive as a country, as an economy?
Yeah, you did right. I mean, what do? Right, we take energy and we transform matter into products. So energy is a major input to essentially every single activity that we do. Some of it's very obvious and some of it's not so obvious, but it's all energy is the major input. And without cheap, reliable energy, as you say, Jaspreet, it's very, very hard to grow out of any sort of economic situation that we've got ourselves into here. And that's a significant concern. I can't see a pathway at the moment where we have cheaper, more reliable and more abundant energy. I can only see it becoming more and more expensive, which is a bigger and bigger input cost to all of our industries.
Yeah.
Yep. And, we often say on the show that the environment pays all the bills. It's just a lot of people in denial about that. And so, the wake up is we're trying to make our listeners at least understand this is a serious matter. Having energy tensions in New Zealand is not a smart place to be in. You do need market tensions, don't get me wrong, but when government policy is directing weird investment decisions, then I think we've got a problem. And I do believe, even though I was in the sector, I do believe that we actually have had a bit too much of a push on the wind and solar front for a long time. And it sounds so virtuous, it seems so nice, but actually it's costly and it's not going to keep us with reliable, low-cost energy anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, we need the power. So however we can get it, we've got to get it. The more intermittent and renewable nature, the more expensive it's going to be. I think that's a fairly well understood concept now globally. If you look at any of those markets that have had a large penetration, but at the end of the day, none of that works without the gas as well as the firming capacity, and it's this gas situation that concerns me the most. We're really exposed there, and we don't have. We don't have any neighbours that we can just grab a bit of gas off of, or
Down
put a bit of nuclear power in across the fence. Yeah, so it's
not as simple as bringing it on a ship to New Zealand and plugging it into the main pipeline. It's not that simple. Is that what you're saying? You talked about implementation's not easy.
The plug's missing, Don. The pipeline's there, but the plug's missing.
There you go.
No, we don't have any sort of facilities that we can take LNG and regasify it or anything like that.
Right.
So, gosh. It's also, those ships are quite large, so they pull a lot of draft. So whether they can even get into, I mean, smaller ones can, but, again, scales of economy and how much do you want to pay is the question, yeah.
So we've got a lot of thinking to do in this country, haven't we? I hope your influence is getting through to the big boys and girls in Wellington and the ministry. What's your thoughts?
I doubt it, but I mean, I've just tried to create some help people to develop some energy literacy. One of the problems that we've got is that when we talk about things, and we've even done it tonight, right? We've talked about electricity and gas as if they're interchangeable and they're the same thing. They're not, right? So gas is a raw material as much as it's an actual, it's an industrial raw material as much as it's an energy supply. So we need all of these things. If we're going to prosper and we're going to get ourselves out of this financial hole and improve our standards of living and these sorts of things, we need to optimize all of the energy gradients that we've got available to us. And at the moment, we're losing different energy sources, and the ones that we've got are becoming more and more fragile. And we're just introducing more and more entropy into the system. So it becomes a very... It's not a good look in terms of the future, as far as I can see, and it makes it very, very difficult for anyone that's trying to do business here to be successful.
Yeah, sobering stuff, Larry. Look, we've had a fair chunk of your time, and again, it helps our listeners, it helps us understand the market place of the energy marketplace effectively, and it is important that. We encourage our listeners to go to your Substack, New Zealand Energy, and listen and read that stuff, because I read it and it helps. Every little bit of this stuff helps. So good work. May you keep up putting out your little missives every so often. And I think we all learn from them. So thanks for coming back on RCR Greenwashed. And, we're living and learning and appreciative of your efforts. So thank you, Larry.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the work you guys do too. It's really good to get these narratives out there and get people thinking about these things. It's pretty easy just to wake up in the morning and turn the light switch on and the light goes and take it for granted. But there's a lot of stuff happening behind the light switch, and it needs to be maintained and protected. Yep.
Yeah, well, we want that. Yeah, absolutely. We need that to keep happening. I'm pretty much a softie, and I need the power on every morning. I don't like it when it's off. And it's not often, but it alters your life. Can't have that.
It does, definitely.
All good. Thanks, Larry.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.